Like I said at the beginning, this is a speaker meeting, and I'm delighted to be the person to introduce our speaker this evening, who's come along to share his or was willing to come and share his experience, strength, and hope with us this evening. This is another person that I met online. Seems that a lot most of the people I know in my NA world these days I've met online, and over the years we've become real friends. And I just had the pleasure of spending a weekend with him, getting to know each other a bit, which has been really nice because one of our story is that I decided to ask him to sponsor me one day and go and see him, and he phoned me up the day I was about to leave and asked me to sponsor him. So we have a relationship that's actually very interesting. It works for us. And with that, I'm just going to introduce you to Michael, who's going to share his experience, strength, and hope with us for 40 to 45 minutes, and hopefully
Sure.
share with us his something that's Wednesday. He hit a particular milestone in recovery, so I'm hoping he's going to share us how he's managed to do that. So, Michael, over to you, my friend.
Thank you, Steve. Can everyone
Good.
hear me?
Yes,
Sure.
Michael.
Certainly
Yes,
can, yes.
Michael.
Yeah.
Hi, Michael.
Loud and clear.
Hello. Hello. Somehow the butterflies just, even though there's nobody in, there's people in the room, I still feel the butterflies because I'm online. And but I'm grateful and thank you, Steve, for asking me when I was down. That was my first time down where to see Steve, and I had a glorious time. And God, I'm nervous. It's funny because I've probably done a million shares, and I probably, and I still, to this very day, cannot, I cannot always come. I've been thinking about this share for like the last 2.5 hours, walking my dog, and as we're speaking, I'm folding clothes, so I'm trying to do, two things at once. So I would be less nervous. Last Wednesday, I celebrated 31 years in Narcotics Anonymous and in recovery. And the answer, the question that Steve posed, how did I get 31 years and still maintain some semblance of sanity? For starters, I'm probably the most insane person that I know, and B, I haven't a fucking clue. But what I do know is I haven't picked up in 31 years, which is a miracle in itself. I didn't see that one coming either. And I still, this very day, don't know how I managed to stay. The funniest thing is I heard somebody said that they had X amount of years clean and serene, and the next line was serene. That's basically a lot of my recovery had to do with learning to live within my own skin. And when I was pondering that, when I was pondering my share, one of the things that hit me like a ton of bricks is I really didn't know how to have. I didn't have hope. As a matter of fact, that was never in my vocabulary. I didn't know what hope was until I got here. I didn't know what recovery was because I didn't know I had a problem until I started coming to meetings and realized that was, I thought drugs were my problem, and I found out that the man in the mirror was the problem. And through hook and by crook, through working on myself for the most part, I have a semblance of sanity that works for me today. What can, oh goodness. Well, I guess I can start at the beginning. I was born and raised in Sacramento, California. And at that time, it was very different. If I was born in the 60s, so it was a very different time. And My parents are both from the south, from the south of from the United States and the South. My mother was born in Manning, and my father was born in New Orleans. And the thing was, they came over to California, especially Sacramento, to find a better way of life. Had I known, but what they brought with them, they brought all their southernness, and they brought all their what they grew up having with them. And I'll probably touch on that a little bit later. But basically, I was born and raised there. And one of the things that I can say that the first thing I ever got addicted to, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day, and it was like, what was the first thing you were addicted to? And they thought it was kind of an odd question. And I thought, no. And not necessarily drugs. I just meant, what was the first thing you were addicted to? And he said football. And I realized that my drug of choice at when I was young was attention, and then it became coffee, and then Coca-Cola. Oh no, Coca-Cola, then coffee. Because for some weird reason, I thought at 11 years of age, I was already an adult, so I had the right to have a coffee. And then at 11 years of age, I believe it was the day, I cannot remember the day, but I can remember the moment and what happened. I had two brothers that were older than me, and they died in a drowning accident. So I have this insane phobia of being, and funniest thing is, a few years down the road, I was in the Boy Scouts. I nearly drowned because I jumped in the swimming pool not knowing how to swim. I thought it couldn't be that hard, so I dropped to the bottom of the pool. But I won't go into, but anyway, my brothers died, and that was the moment life as I knew it changed, and not for the better. And we all had our way of coping skills. My coping skills was dealing to deal with it. I was coming to grips to other things too. But one of the things that was heir apparent was I was coming out of the closet. I was coming out of the closet. I'm not sure why I'm having a hard time saying that, but anyway, I was coming out of the closet and recognizing that I was attracted to boys rather than girls. And that kind of almost sealed my fate. It was one of those things I couldn't say to anybody. And the other things that kind of helped along the way was my brothers were dead, and my father was angry and became more of an alcohol. He always drank, but he was never an alcoholic. He just drank. And then it shifted to him drinking too much, and then my mother becoming addicted to pills. She was also a school teacher, so she sort of ingrained in me all the stuff that I needed to learn, which is, how to read, how to write, and whatnot. But the irony to all that was I never graduated college, I mean high school. I went to high school, hated it with a passion, and wanted out in a big way. And my very first time I ever did drugs, I was 15 years old. It was also the first time I ever had sex with somebody. It was also the first time, it was all, and the funniest thing was, it was all in the same day. And I remember this person as much as I yesterday. And I really liked it. And I realized something else, that I was stoned and I had no idea what to do with it. I remember going home and trying to act normal. And when you're 15 years old, well, I always thought it was strange, but when you're 15 years old, you really don't know. It was like, I didn't know what normal was because I came from a very chaotic house. We always fought each other and whatnot. And I remember first time I ran away, I was 16 years old. And I really wanted out of that house. I really wanted out. And I liked being away from home. I liked being away from that chaos. As a matter of fact, I went from one chaotic situation to another one. And but at least that chaotic situation was people I wanted to be in chaos with, not people I didn't want to be in chaos with. And the people I hung out with showed me how to drink, how to use, until they got sick of my shit. I had a real bad identity crisis because the funniest thing was I wanted to be who I was, but I didn't want to be that representation, if you know what I mean, of who, what I thought being gay was. And I wasn't really interested in the club scenes then, and I'm still not now, which is kind of strange because I'm with somebody that's all he's with, loves. I love contradictions. And as it were, when I dropped out of high school, I just found those cr that crowd. I hung out with everybody I possibly could. I used everybody I possibly could. They got me high. They got me loaded. I met a few years down the road, I met this person who introduced me to speed, and that was and that was what I was looking for all my life. I wanted that feeling. I wanted that. When I did speed, it answered everything. It l ended my loneliness. It ended my isolationism. It ended everything that I thought I wanted out of life. And I just recently saw some videos in that was put up by the Montana drug of Montana, probably police, or I don't know what it is, but they advertise about crystal meth, and people said, "Not even once, meth, not even once." Well, guess what? I ignored. If they told me not even once, I was going to ignore it. So, because I realized I found my drug of choice, and I chased after that for the next maybe 5 years with absolutely heavy consequences, to the point that my mother didn't want anything to do with me. My family just didn't want anything to do with me. I was homeless. I was jobless. I was penniless. And then I ran into this crowd. I wound up hanging out at this one cafe that had this extremely punk crowd there. And I mean, when in 1980, there was a real heavy punk scene that was happening in Sacramento. And I was part of that. I really loved it. And for the first time, it wasn't an issue that I was gay. As a matter of fact, that was the last thing. They just loved the fact that I was really into what they were into. And needless to say, they had more. I tried other drugs outside of meth. And the only one I haven't tried, and I must say, it probably. I'll tell you a quickie. I wound up needing to go to the bathroom one night, and there was this guy who was shooting up in the bathroom. And I remember this distinctly. He looked up at me and said, "Don't even go there. Don't even try this." And that kind of said, "Oh, I'm not going to do that." That was the only time that I actually listened to somebody about not using. But outside of that, it was full steam ahead. Like I said, I used for 10 years, and I found myself homeless at one point, sleeping on people's couches, going to food banks, selling my plasma to get money. And strangely enough, and I have to say, some people I don't know how in the hell I did it, and I'm not going to even go there to try to figure it out, but I really didn't spend that much money on my addiction, to be honest with you. And I don't think that that had anything to do with the fact that I was that great, but people had drugs and they liked sharing them, and I happened to be one of the participants to share it with. So, that was my lot, my lot in life. I was damn determined never to go back home, and I didn't. I finally found a place at 20 something years of age to live. I got booted out of that place because I was living with somebody, and he booted me out because he couldn't stand my behavior. And years down the road, I found out that this man committed suicide, but and there, it was a heavy heart. I always felt like that I played a part in that. But booted out, got kicked out again. My mother took me back, and this time, and she booted me out again. It was the endless cycle. And somewhere along the way in 1988, I ran into this person who got me, who was this real eccentric artist, and I don't know why in the world he was my friend. He just ended up being my friend, and he was moving out of his place, and he told me, "You can move into my place." And I said, "But I don't have any money." Somewhere along the way, I got a job. I don't know how in the hell I kept it, but I got a job, and he moved. I moved in just right away, and didn't. And I slept on the floor, and I had a Murphy bed that had a spring that kept coming out, and it was like. But you know what? At least I had my own place. And it was the first time I ever had my own place in my life. And probably, and come think of it, it's I think my last. But anyway, no, I take that back. I had one in San Francisco, but that's another story that I'll get to. Oh yeah. Went around. I wound up using up a lot, using a lot, and living in this apartment I used in until I think it was June 4th, 1988. And I remember that day distinctly because I had been on a very long run. By the way, I will tell you, my last 2 years, at least the last 2 years of my using, I don't remember ever being clean. I don't remember not having something in my system, whether it be alcohol or pot or acid or what or more meth or what have you. I don't remember not being clean during my last 2 years of using. And I had a friendship with a girl named June, who basically was one of my punk rock friends, who to this very day is one of my closest friends. And she's not in recovery, but she's one of those people who championed me to be in recovery. I do have those champions in my life still. And one day, after a very long run, I was late to work, and she came over, and she wanted to do that. And all I could think of was I wanted to kick this. I wanted to beat the living shit out of her. And I thought, this is not happening. And the only thing that saved me from just ruining a really good relationship was the fact that I was late to an hour late to work. And I got the biggest bollocking that you could possibly get from my boss. And that was kind of one of those days. It was one of those days. It was just one of those days. Got off of work, and just give you some context. The cafe that I met all these punk rockers in closed years ago, years later, years before. And there was another coffee shop I hung out with where all the punkers hung out. But the strange thing about this particular coffee shop, there was a lot of people in recovery there. I remember that day my friend Kenny was there, and he's asked me, "How's it going?" And I told him, that I was having a bad day and I probably bent his ear. And he looked at me and said to me, "I can't help you, but I know a place that could." So he took me to my very first Narcotics Anonymous meeting on 29th and T Street, and it was a blazingly hot day in June. And I remember the room was full with people and full of happy faces, and I was miserable, and I was feeling embarrassed of being there, needing to be there, and whatnot. And I couldn't look up and see people's faces, but I could tell you what they wore. They wore a Stan Smith Adidas. They wore Nike Cortezes and Sperry Topsiders. That was the fashion back in 1988. And what I did was, and oh, I didn't remember anything from that meeting except the girl sitting behind me saying that she was going to LA with 9 months clean. And I thought to myself, why the fuck would you want to go to LA? And much less, I didn't hear the 9 months clean. I didn't think about clean time then. So I managed not to use for 2 weeks and decided to go to a party. And the girl gave me a joint. And lo and behold, whatever was said in that meeting came rushing in my head. You know that line about Narcotics Anonymous will fuck up your high? Well, it sure in the hell fucked up mine. And so I immediately needed to go to a meeting, and I had no idea where one was because I didn't have NA schedule. We call them schedules here. They call them where-to-finds in Scotland, where I'm talking to you, which I'll get to probably in a few minutes. And I did my very first 18 months in the Mother's Fellowship. And I have no problem saying that it helped me stay clean. Because there was a hell of a lot of people in that room that were not also alcoholics but drug addicts. And one of the people that were was initially one of the first drug addicts I ever met was named Joyce, who was a biker chick who had, and we became fast friends. And she was the one that introduced me back to Narcotics Anonymous via doing service. And I was the chair of, I was the merchandise chair for our Unity Day. And remember, she got me to be the chair of the merchandise, and I went for it without even knowing what the hell you did as a merchandise chair, but I did it anyway. And it turned out to be a very successful Unity Day, and I felt very proud. But I also realized I had to go to NA meeting. So there happened to be, somebody told me there was one on 29th and T Street, P Street. And that was the meeting that I actually went to, my very first Narcotics Anonymous meeting in a very, in a 18 months. And I realized that I felt like an alien there. And there was this guy, big guy named John T, who gave me a big hug and told me, "Welcome home." And I'm very cognizant of the time. And from that point on, I felt at home in Narcotics Anonymous. Because one of the things, when getting back to that cafe, that punk rock cafe, nobody cared. You know, the funniest thing about being in recovery is I realized nobody really cared whether I was gay or where I got my drugs or who I hung out with or who I slept with. None of that shit mattered. What they cared about is what my problem was and what I was willing to do about it. And interestingly enough, and I say this because it's not trying to be different, because I was l solely realizing that how different I was, and yet felt that I didn't feel, and I'll say this, I w didn't quite feel that acceptance, and just and but When I was in Sacramento, I was openly gay and going to an NA, and there wasn't a lot of gay, black, openly people in recovery. So I was kind of an anomaly. But all the people that accepted me told me something that you may be the only one, but for now. And you know what? And I'm grateful that those people supported me. About 3.5 years into recovery, I went to, and this is my favorite story about my recovery, I could tell you, where I actually found the acceptance that I was so craving. I went to a friend of mine dropped me off at a what do you call that? For lack of a better word, a Lano club, and I didn't know it was the North Sac group of Narcotics Anonymous. And I had no idea what this group was about, and I didn't particularly care. I just knew it was an NA meeting, so I needed an NA meeting. So he dropped me off, took off as if it was, and there was a row of Harley Davidsons there. And I thought to myself, am I sure you're in the right place? And I walked into the meeting, and there was this big guy named Randy. For some reason, all these big guys just like giving me hugs. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, this big guy named Randy told me, welcome home. And also, he was asking, are you packing? And I said to myself, packing? What would I be packing? Someone said, he's fine. Don't worry about it. And there was a lock box next to the door that people kept their guns and their weaponry in the meeting. That was, you know, in a nice little Ziploc baggie, so therefore, and they could claim it a little bit later. But basically, it was just out of the safety of the group. You never know when a fight will break out. Anyway, at that meeting, I sat at that meeting thinking to myself, oh, I don't know if I belong here, and I wanted to leave. And next to me was this guy who was a Fijian, who was darker than me, but he had 12 years clean. Now, if he's still around, he probably has a little over 45. And one of the things he said was, you belong here. And I said, and you know, it, and even though this was a biker meeting, they let me stay. And it wasn't a biker meeting, it was a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And they told me I could stay. And it didn't matter where I came from, didn't matter what I did, and didn't matter what my sexuality is, because it says in our readings, and age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion, they just wanted to know I wanted to stay clean. And those people, strangely enough, gave me the acceptance that for years from my family I didn't get, and from my friends I got, but no, but sparingly. But I actually felt it. I actually felt it. And since that time, even though I didn't go to, oh, I went to my very first, thanks to Joyce, she took me to my very first Narcotics Anonymous convention, the World Convention that was in Portland, Oregon in 1990. And I tell you something, I was so paranoid because there were little people there. I just really do cry. But he was loving and caring, and I stuck it out in my hotel room and tried to, and I had to take deep breaths just to go to the meetings. But when I went to that biker meeting, it was the thing that made me feel accepted. I found a sponsor in Narcotics Anonymous who was had two or 3 years more than me, and the main reason why I asked him to be my sponsor because he was doing service, and to me, service was one of the things that kept me clean and kept me coming back, and it's still one of the things that keeps me clean and coming back. And I love Mark for that reason. I call him a little redneck because that's what that's what he called himself. He was a little redneck, but he had no judgment. He did not tell me what to do or what not to do. He just suggested, and he suggested work step one. And you know, and there are times when I realize step one doesn't necessarily mean I'm powerless over drugs. Sometimes I'm powerless over people, places, things, situations, events, and circumstances. And what I nosedive in my life becomes unmanageable. The other thing too was when I got to my step two, I just like didn't believe, and I still have this hard time believing. But he said, you don't have to believe. It doesn't require you to believe. Just believe that we believe, and that will help you in your belief. So for a long time, and some days it's Narcotics Anonymous, sometimes it's the waves on the shore, sometimes it's the wind in the sky, sometimes it's Ms. Cornwell that I turn my will and life over the care of. And every day I make a decision to turn my will and life over. If it wasn't for the fact that I did a fourth step on myself that was really shockingly embarrassing, and talk to somebody about it. I was so pissed off that this person just like thought, this is that it? Is that all? And I thought, I was burying my soul with this guy, and he was just like, if that's all, then wow. Because I didn't know where resentment was, and I subsequently years down the road, I know where resentment is. It's the re-feeling. So it made more sense to kind of navigate through all that. And some of my resentments, one of the ones was to my mother and my father, because I really was pissed off by them because they were so angry and they took all this shit out on me. Having forgotten that they lost two very important children in their life, one was going to be a preacher and the other one was going to be a baseball player, and their dreams and aspirations went down the tubes and that, and they never got over it. It humbled me enough to learn that, you know, they did the best they could with the tools they had. And, you know, a lot of my character defects still come up, and I still work on them in the very day. Sometimes I have to catch myself when I'm in the middle of one. You know, I have to say to you, years down the road, and I was just saying, years down the road, I understood, when I was doing my eighth and ninth step, I didn't know what I needed to make amends to my parents for. So I remember before my father died, my father came to my place, and I hadn't seen my father in close to 15 years at that time because my parents divorced. And I hadn't seen my father about that time for 15 years. The best amends I could make was say, I'm sorry, I'm not the son that you wanted. And he told me that you are the son that we always wanted. And when I made my amends to my mom, she said to me that, you know, I said the same thing to her. And she said, well, you know, you've always been independent. And you always taught me that your independence meant something to you. So, you know, and she, when she died, when I found out she died, I was upset. You know, I was very upset, of course, but I felt cleansed from the fact that I did make amends to my mother. I actually gave her my 17-year chip just so she knows that I've been around. You know, along the way, I also moved. I moved from Sacramento to San Francisco, and my life undoubtedly changed. About 2006, I met this person who I'm now with. I've been with for 13 years. I met him in San Francisco and made one of my biggest fears is being on an airplane, having not flown in an airplane. And And at the time, I got a different sponsor because Mark moved elsewhere, and finding a sponsor with time. And I found this wonderful transformed woman by the name of Billy, who was so tough that you would, you wouldn't want to fuck with her. Let's put it that way. And she told me, you can get any, you can, and she was one of the ones that told me you can have anything you want in recovery, anything. And if you want to see him again, you have to get on that fucking airplane and get over to Scotland. And it's like, but, and it's like, just do it. And at the time, I got a different job where I couldn't really afford the airfare. But my at that time when I moved, when I'm leaving a lot of story out because I know I'm running into time. But I had a flatmate that paid help. That gave me the money to go on this trip to see James and fell in love with Scotland right then and there. Fell in love with him right then and there. And everything else is history from that point on. I've been through a lot of trials and tribulations in my recovery. And one of the ones that kind of stand out to me. I was listening to a podcast with a noted author, and he was talking about the Black dysphoria, the diaspora, and he was talking somewhat about, which answered a very long-standing question that always plagued me about my parents. And they were talking about how angry, when my parents moved from South Carolina and New Orleans to Sacramento, California, they thought their life would be different. And in a very fundamental way, it was, but it wasn't because they still felt the racism and whatnot that they felt when they were living in the South, but just not as direct in their face. And they were completely angry. They were always angry. And I wondered for a long time why I, some of my anger came from them, and it dawned on me that their anger never got resolved. I didn't face the same kind of racism they faced. And so that kind of helped me understand my parents' plight because I became open-minded to know that was what my parents had to do and how they had to survive. And through working the program on myself, I saw my own anger come pop. And with the help of, I had a sponsor here who had, I found out I had at the time, 9 years clean, and I had 20 something odd years clean, and I was thinking, oh God, it's going to be tough finding a sponsor with over 30 years clean or 28, 20, whatever amount, double digit, because when I moved to Scotland. There was only one person that had more clean time than I did, and he just up and disappeared. And so I became the old timer in Edinburgh. I'm sure there's pretty much other ones in Scotland, but I'm pretty much the old timer in Edinburgh. And I needed a sponsor, and that's where that the connection, and somehow through one of the social media pages, I met this guy who happened to be my sponsor today, and now I'm his sponsor too, which he alluded to, and we have this amazing relationship. And as a matter of fact, I've had nothing but amazing relationships, amazing things happen to me. And one of my biggest other fears was I was going to be judged for being different until I went to Pogarisha. I met a man who in recovery who is one of my closest friends and oh shit, who lives in Norway and convinced me to go to with him to the winter convention in Pogarisha, Montenegro. And I said, okay, I'll go. Where the fuck is Pogarisha, Montenegro? And so I just got tickets and I wound up going there. And I went to a convention where the primary language wasn't English. And it was relatively small. And these people were just desperate for recovery. And this small little fellowship of people. I mean, for them, they had over 120 people, and that was a huge convention for them. And they were so grateful that somebody from Edinburgh, Scotland, who was originally from California, would come to their little convention and show that there was recovery, recovery is possible for those people, because they'd never seen somebody, you know, a lot of them never seen black people, a lot, except on television, and never seen one in flesh. And the funniest thing is, a lot of them didn't cap on the fact that they just thought it was kind of unique. Didn't cap on the fact that I was gay, nor did they care. And they did not care. They cared about the fact that I was a recovering addict carrying the message of recovery to people who never heard, who couldn't make, you know, outside of their country. You know, since I started this journey about 31 years ago, I never dreamt that, you know, when I was living in Sacramento, I know the only difference between somebody who's been incarcerated versus me, versus where I never got into jail. I didn't get my clean time through a treatment center or anything. And there's no knock if you got your recovery through jail or treatment center, that, you know what, wherever you get your get the message is fine with me. But one of the things that what I realized from somebody who shared, the only difference between my prison and their prison is my prison was a lot bigger, and my prison was, I was stuck in a, I wasn't, could not get that, couldn't get that far away from my using buddies and my drugs. And the funniest thing is, every time I go to the Kirkgate, which is down the street from where I live here in Edinburgh, I see the same people all the time, do the same thing all the time, whether I'm on the bus going to work or going to the little that's right there. I see the same people hang out, and they're on methadone, and they're just trapped. They don't know, you know, and I know some of those people have been to meetings before. I know that they know the message. But sometimes it's just the idea, you know, and they don't recognize me from the meet, you know, either they don't recognize me from the meetings, or they don't want to acknowledge the fact that they know me from the meetings. But it doesn't matter. I'm there. And I realize that they're entrapped. They're caught up. They can't go anywhere, do anything. And you know, the freedom I feel today is the freedom that was promised to me, not just from freedom active addiction, but freedom to do whatever you fuck you want if you're willing to pay the price of admission. And every day I pay the price of admission by just doing what I have to do. And what I try to do is give back as much as possible. I'm just going to leave it there, because I know I can talk for Scotland right now. But thank you for listening, and thank you for, you know, helping me celebrate my 31st year of recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. It's been, you know what, I must say, I can't say it's ever been boring, and it's an, and but it's been a great, you know, it's been a great ride. I love all the ups and downs. I love the roller coaster ride, but you know, it was, in the end, it's been well fucking worth it. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much for letting me share. Cheers.